You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
I'm Deanne Jennings, and I'm here to share data and dive into the world of finance with you.
Advisors associated with Prout Financial Design may be either 1, registered representatives with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC, and investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, or 2, solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, and not affiliated with LPL Financial. Investment advice offered through CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, CG Advisory Services, and Prout Financial Design are separate entities from LPL Financial. Dennis Prout and Nathan Prout are solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services and are not affiliated with LPL Financial. The opinions voiced in this show program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriately qualified professional before making a decision.
WTCM News Talk 580. Welcome aboard. Thursday morning, it's time for New Retirement Radio with Prout Financial Design, starring Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir.
Well, it's great to be here, live and in the flesh.
Live.
Baby.
Unless it's Saturday.
Unless it's Saturday, which we are on a rebroadcast then, which will be the 7th, today being 9/5/2024. Oh, well, good morning and welcome. We are so happy to have you here with us. If you do have a question of a financial nature that you'd like to ask through text line or otherwise, phone call.
You can call us at 947-0023 or you can text at that same number, 947-0023.
Wow, what a summer. It's hard to believe it's past tense as we've gotten through Labor Day here. Summer writing, continuing ed, is telling Heidi here this morning. Oh, by the way, Heidi Cartwright, good morning. RICP and Managing Director of Prout Financial. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Dennis. I'm delighted to be here today, being back after Ron was off last week. So we were off of the radio as well.
It's wild, isn't it? It's wild, wild stuff, Hal. Now, the interesting part, I think, we were talking about the continuing education program that I'm a part of with CPWA, the Certified Private Wealth Advisor. And some of the components of that are just so good that I want to intend to share these in the coming weeks. One of the primary ones I found most interesting was brain health. Obviously, we're not doctors, nor do we pretend to be one on TV, but it's incredible information. And so as a part of the aging process, and not only aging, but financially as well, we have a lot to discuss here in the coming weeks, and looking forward to engaging in that. And two, Deanne Jennings, our Director of Operations.
Good Hello, morning Deanne. To all our listeners. Happy September. I love September. It's my favorite month in Traverse City.
Is it really?
It's a beautiful month.
Yes.
I love it, too.
It's calmer, but the weather is still really nice and the sun's shining. It's beautiful.
So the fudgies have all left?
I was trying to be politically correct.
Yeah, I just thought I'd say it out loud. So this is great. Oh, we've got a very special program today. Joining us is Heather Cartwright. That last name sounds familiar, Heidi.
It does. It sounds really familiar to me.
What is the deal with that? So Heather is Heidi's older sister. And Heather...
more mature. I had to say it, sorry.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. Heather Cartwright, retired director of the Federal Crimes Victim Division with the U.S. Department of Justice. See if you can repeat that one again, huh? Gives an eyewitness look behind the scenes of the U.S. government's response to the largest mass attack on our shores. After the break, we're going to play George Bush's speech from that time, but hearken back to it. And, you know, first of all, your family's long history in the community is extensive, going all the way back to Judge Parm Gilbert, correct?
That's That's right.
My great-grandfather.
Yes, your great-grandfather, Parm Gilbert. So you have deep connections to the Traverse City community yourself.
Yes. Although we grew up all around the country, we came here every summer to the family house, and we feel like this is home.
A lot of great memories here, yes.
Mm-hmm. I believe it. You were directly impacted being only a short distance from the Pentagon, which was crashed into by a plane. So you, as a part of this, were fearing for you and your coworkers' safety as a part of this attack, which is an incredible part of the story. So this affected you deeply personally because you had a friend, a good friend, who died in one of the planes that went into the Trade Center?
Pentagon.
Into the Pentagon itself. So this, while it's been 23 years now almost since the day that that occurred, this has got to be extremely real to you still as you recount it.
Well, it's something you never forget. Mm-hmm. And I think actually most Americans who are alive on that day can tell you where they were.
Exactly what they were doing.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's burned into our memories, our collective memories, if you will. Absolutely. So let's start at the beginning. You are, retired from that division. Start us with the timeline, if you would, of what happened on that day, the beginnings of that day, maybe even how that day began for you, your position within the U.S. Department of Justice, and what your job was, all those sorts of things, if you could just start us with that.
Sure. Well, why don't I start with my position and then
Perfect.
I'll go to the day.
Yes.
I worked for the Justice Department in Washington for 30 years, and I had started as a federal prosecutor.
So a long time, long time employee, 30 years with them.
Yes.
Okay.
And as a civil servant, I'm not a political appointee, so I started as a prosecutor, a line prosecutor in the District of Columbia. And at the time this happened on 9/11, I worked for the Office for Victims of Crime, which is a part of the Justice Department that manages grants to crime victim programs, does policy work for crime victim issues within the Justice Department. And one of the things we were responsible for is administering the Crime Victims Fund. This money comes from federal offenders when they're convicted in court and they have to pay a fine to the government. That money goes into a trust fund, just not the general treasury of the U.S., but a trust fund called the Crime Victims Fund. And that money is used to pay for programs for crime victims in the states and in the federal government.
So these are federal crimes. Define what a federal crime is, if you would.
So a federal crime is going to be something that affects the whole country. And there has to be, under the Constitution, a nexus with a crime that goes across state lines. So terrorism is a federal crime. You have wire fraud are federal crimes. Anything that will affect more than one state.
Okay. All right. So significant, I don't know how else to say it, significant crime. Huge terrorist types of attacks is where the government would, in essence, sue these people for, in essence, retribution.
Prosecute them.
Yes. Yeah.
But it also includes, I think you said yesterday, it also included corporations that may get fined at a federal level. That money would go into the victims' fund, right?
Yes. Yeah. Like antitrust cases, securities fraud.
Okay. All right.
So so we administered that funding to support crime victim programs. So that's what I was doing on that day, and I was responsible for federal crimes. So I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac River from downtown Washington, D.C., about 20 minutes from my office. I was driving in around 8:30 in the morning on 395, the 14th Street Bridge, which goes right by the Pentagon. Went right by the Pentagon, got to my office, and my boss came in and said, I've just heard that a plane hit one of the trade towers in New York City.
And I was thinking, oh, maybe some small plane got off course and hit it. So I said that to her. She goes, I don't know. Why don't you come in? And we have it on television. So I went in, and we were watching cable news. And as we were standing there, we saw the second plane come in and hit the second tower. And
so that was live.
That was live on television. Yeah. So it was obviously not an accident. You could see how the plane was aiming for the tower.
So you could see that yourself.
We
you
could
say
see
obviously,
it on television.
But you said out loud something I thought was really interesting. If you would say it.
Well, it was not an accident.
It was
an intentional flying into the building. So, is what it appeared to us. When you have one tower already on fire, and then you see a plane come and hit the second one. But within, I would say, less than 5 minutes, we had a phone call from the National Transportation Safety Board, which investigates plane crashes, basically telling us these are no accident. We're under attack. This is an intentional flight, which meant that it was a crime, probably a terrorism crime, and it would be our responsibility as the Justice Department to coordinate the response for the crime victims.
Amazing. So you had said that we talked to you a couple of days ago, and when you said that you knew that from the get-go, that really struck me, because I remember watching it. I saw it myself, and I remember thinking, what could this be? What is going on? You know, it looked intentional, but who would have thought? So you had a circle of thought that, in essence, given the information that you had as a part of that, there had been threats to us, if
yes.
you will, terrorist threats. So you were kind of piecing this together in your mind. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Well, we were already working with several prior attacks from Al-Qaeda. There was the East Africa embassy bombings from 1998, the USS Cole bombing in October of 2000. So we knew that there were threats against the United States and all of our facilities around the world. So when you see something on this scale of two jetliners flying into buildings, you have a pretty good idea this must be an Al-Qaeda effort.
It still blows my mind. It just does, to think that they could fly two planes into that trade center like that.
Here's
yes, Ron.
A quick clip. Bryant Gumbel, a name from the past, was on the Today Show that morning with their first report.
It's 8:52 here in New York. I'm Bryant Gumbel. We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan. You're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know anything more than that. We don't know if it was a commercial aircraft.
So that was, like you said, when you got to work, that's about where it was right there.
So that morning in 2001, that's on the Today Show, and I remember that's the show I was watching, as well as a class we were teaching that morning, too. So go ahead. So your experience and or timeline as this is going on.
So the next phone call we got was from the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, who called my boss and confirmed that we were under attack. We don't know the size of the attack yet, but we believe there's going to be thousands of victims. And so we're going to need a plan of what we're going to do. And since our office had funding for crime victims, particularly we had a terrorism reserve fund, which would pay for services for terrorism victims, he was letting us know. And so he said, get to work on it, because I'm going to need to hear back from you.
As to what the plan is, how you intend to help these people, and what it's going to look like, the details.
Yes.
And that was anticipating, that was before the either tower fell?
Right.
And before the Pentagon was hit?
Right.
Wow.
Isn't that perceptive?
That's my recollection. It was before the Pentagon. But the Pentagon, so the second plane hit at 9:03 a.m., and the Pentagon was hit at 9:37, so you have about a half an hour time difference there.
Here, just go back to Bryant Gumbel one more time. Just
sure,
Pentagon.
Ron, thank you.
Here.
Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. We're looking at a live picture from Washington, and there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. It would appear that there has been another major explosion. This one in the nation's capital. You are looking at a scene of apparent blast aftermath, there is smoke in the air over the Pentagon. We don't know whether this is the result of a bomb or whether it is yet another aircraft that has targeted a symbol, the United States power, but there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. This is coming at 9:43 Eastern time.
So we were just getting started, revving up to go to respond to New York, and I was on the 8th floor of a building in downtown Washington, and we could look out and we could see the Pentagon. Mm. And we were in this office, and I don't remember hearing much. Maybe something caught our attention, but we were looking out the window, and we could see the really dark black smoke coming up from the Pentagon. So at that point, what was a response as part of our job to New York became, we are in the line of fire here. We're very close to. Mm. And how many more planes are there?
Right.
Because it was so shocking. I had sent a staff member over to the FBI, where they have the command center, the SIOC, and he was trying to get us information about what was going down on. They were closing down the airspace over the United States, bringing every single plane that was in the air needed to come down immediately.
That was historic, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how quickly did that occur? Do you recall in between the Pentagon attack or the Pentagon being destroyed partially?
I was not part of the loop on the air traffic control on the airplanes. That wasn't my area of responsibility.
Sure.
So we weren't really keyed in on that. What we were worried about was if a plane has hit here, and then very shortly after that, we had a coworker, our office manager, came running down the hallway screaming, "There's another plane, there's another plane." She had heard from her husband, who worked at Andrews Air Force Base, that they were scrambling jets because there was at least one more plane. And so there was a thought it may be coming to Washington, since we'd already had one hit at the Pentagon. So our concern then came, what do we do with our staff? We were very exposed on the top floor of an office building in between the White House and the Capitol building. Mm.
So what was your feeling in your and all the staff that were in your vicinity? You're making it sound so we were concerned, but was there anybody screaming? Was there fear? I mean, you don't know what's going on. This country's under attack.
Right.
What was the atmosphere like there?
Well, Diane was the woman who came down the hallway. She was screaming down the hallway, "There's another plane, there's another plane."
Wow.
Since we had worked the East Africa embassy bombings, we knew about don't want to be by a glass window. A lot of people were blinded and injured in that bombing because they were looking out the window trying to see what was happening. So we did think of that. You know, frankly, when something like that happens, you don't have time to think about being afraid, I don't think, because we needed to figure out what to do with our staff and where to go. And we got a conference room on a lower floor interior with no windows and just got everybody moving. And we did that within about 20 minutes of time, because I know we got down there before the South Tower collapsed, and that was at 9:59. So the hit on the Pentagon was 9:37, and by 9:59, we had moved our staff into the interior of the building. Mm-hmm. And then I remember watching the South Tower fall. And that's when we'd set up televisions and computers in this room to make a little command center. And that's when I saw on the television a picture of one of my friends, a former coworker, Barbara Olson, who had been on the plane that hit the Pentagon.
Wow.
And she had been able to get a phone call out to her husband, who's Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General of the United States, and told him what was happening. And that's one reason I think within the government, so quickly we knew about this. Meanwhile, in Washington, they were taking the vice president down into the bunker under the White
House. That's right, Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney. Mm-hmm. And then they were evacuating the White House and the U.S. Capitol. So, but as a lower-level worker, we weren't getting any direction on what to do from that. We kind of made our own minds up. We're going to get to an interior office building.
Did anybody want to leave the building and, like, say, I'm getting out of here.
Yes.
I want to get my car or the subway and get home.
Yes. Yeah. Well, a lot of people wanted to go and get their children. Yeah. Their children were at school.
Sure.
And so I know my secretary said, I've got to go get my kids. And so she went down into the metro. Now, we were concerned there may be attack on the metro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we warned her, but she was insistent. And very quickly, Washington became gridlocked. You couldn't move because there were so many cars. And another factor was there was a large daycare center at the Pentagon, and a lot of federal employees had their kids over there. So you had people rushing over the 14th Street Bridge to go to the Pentagon to try to see if their kids were okay.
Mm. So, wow. And you have said that attack on the Pentagon, there are five levels of protection around the Pentagon itself. So talk a minute about what that was like in terms of the attack on the Pentagon directly.
So the Pentagon was built to be a fortress, and it has five rings. And so there's a ring of offices, and then there's open space, a ring of offices, open space. So this plane, it crashed into the helicopter pad on the south side of the Pentagon building, and it slid into the outer ring of the Pentagon, and it actually went into the fourth ring, and through the nose of the plane went through the third ring. So these are thick, heavy, several feet deep walls of brick and stone and cement block that the plane slid through. It was going so fast. It was at full throttle when it hit the ground there, right, which was only feet from the Pentagon building itself.
So full throttle by the pilots, whoever they were, the terrorists into the Pentagon itself with that plane.
Yes.
And it was full of fuel. That's where that black smoke, in essence, was coming from, you mentioned earlier.
It was, because that plane had taken off from Dulles Airport, which is in Northern Virginia, and it was headed to Los Angeles, so it was full of fuel. It turned around very shortly after takeoff and came back into the D.C. area. So it was full of fuel.
You asked when they grounded the flights. The FAA
yes.
grounded all the flights at 9:42, just for the timeline there. Some 3,300 commercial flights, 1,200 private planes were guided to airports in Canada and the U.S. over the next 2.5 hours.
They wanted them out of the air, period.
On the ground.
You're down.
Remember, Cherry Capital Airport had at least a dozen aircraft that were nearby that landed over there.
Really?
If you drove by, it was like, wow, look at all the planes over there.
Jeez. Yeah. What a client who was talking about this yesterday in the classroom said he was driving near, he was driving near one of the Air Force bases, and he said he saw those planes take off. He said he'd never seen the jets take off almost straight up. He said he was trying to think, you know, why are they doing that? They were listening to the reports of the attack. But that's where they were, I would guess, they were going after and or trying to intercept any other attacks.
Right now we're going to play the address 23 years ago almost. President Bush, after a hectic day, went on the air on television with a brief address to hopefully, I guess, calm people's nerves and let them know what was happening. Here is the address from September 11, 2001.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger. These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat, but they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shattered steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve. America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world, and no one will keep that light from shining. Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature, and we responded with the best of America, with the daring of our rescue workers, with the caring for strangers and neighbors who came to give blood and help in any way they could. Immediately following the first attack, I implemented our government's emergency response plans. Our military is powerful, and it's prepared. Our emergency teams are working in New York City and Washington, D.C. to help with local rescue efforts. Our first priority is to get help to those who have been injured and to take every precaution to protect our citizens at home and around the world from further attacks. The functions of our government continue without interruption. Federal agencies in Washington, which had to be evacuated today, are reopening for essential personnel tonight and will be open for business tomorrow. Our financial institutions remain strong, and the American economy will be open for business as well. The search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them. I appreciate so very much the members of Congress who have joined me in strongly condemning these attacks. And on behalf of the American people, I thank the many world leaders who have called to offer their condolences and assistance. America and our friends and allies join with all those who want peace and security in the world. And we stand together to win the war against terrorism. Tonight, I ask for your prayers for all those who grieve, for the children whose worlds have been shattered, for all whose sense of safety and security has been threatened. And I pray they will be comforted by a power greater than any of us, spoken through the ages in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. This is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you. Good night. And God bless America.
All right, almost 23 years ago, that night, September 11th, the president, with a brief address, and probably people, I don't know, our guest today is Heather Cartwright with Prout Financial Design. She's not with Prout, but she's here on behalf of Prout as a special guest, was in D.C. on that date. Did you watch the address? Do you remember that, watching it that night?
I don't remember specifically that address. I was still at work until about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and I think this was on television earlier in the evening. But we were getting a 1-800 number up so that people who were missing a loved one and didn't know what had happened to them were unable to contact them so that they could start calling in and we could start creating a victim list to figure out who was the victim of this crime.
Wow. You remember that footage, mostly in New York City, though, people walking around with these homemade placards with a picture of their loved one, their phone number, and said, if you see this person, please call me. Hundreds of them running around. Yeah,
amazing sights. Yep. And that really helped bring it back, too. Thank you for playing that, Ron, and finding it for us. So you were in process here of getting this whole thing set up on a personal level, as well as it was part of your job. Now, you had been doing this for other countries and other situations for years. What was that like, setting it up so close to home? How did that make you think or feel as a part of this?
Well, actually, we did not. This was one of the first cases that I It was the first case I responded to in time. As a lawyer, I was coming in later. I did work Oklahoma City bombing when it got to be the trial phase.
Okay.
And I was working on East Africa Embassy bombings, USS Cole, in the aftermath. But 9/11 was the first case where I was responsible for the immediate response during the crime. And then in years after that, I have done the work with foreign countries on foreign attacks.
Okay.
So this is really where I learned. I knew a little bit, but where I learned, and I saw what I think was an excellent model that we did at the Pentagon to support the victims of the Pentagon. Since I was right there in Washington, that's where I went and worked with those victims. I had staff that went to New York, but I was there.
So being a part of it that close to you and being threatened, in essence, really brought it home in terms of the importance of your job and your duty, but also then using it later, communicating that to other countries even as to what they might do. Talk a bit about that, how yes. they would respond.
Well, this 9/11 really changed the arc of my career because, as President Bush said, it became a priority for our country, the war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely the high priority of the FBI and the Justice Department for the last 20 years. Congress created an Office of Justice for Victims of Overseas Terrorism, which was for Americans who are victims of terrorism overseas. And I ended up being the director of that office and setting that office, helped to set that office up and work with foreign governments when there were attacks overseas. So that was the capacity that I did that. So I was able to testify before the European Union and the parliament there and go and work with the law enforcement agencies in many different countries on how to set up a response. And unfortunately, after 9/11, not only did we have the Al-Qaeda threat, but then ISIS came on the heels of that. We had Israel has had a long history, the Second Intifada and of the Hamas attacks and other types of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of attacks where Americans were victims outside the U.S. too.
So an ongoing series of attacks that where the infrastructure, in essence, that you put in place has played a direct role in helping them to respond. So talk about what it is that you did as a part of this, what your response was, and how you oversaw this.
Well, I think the great innovation is a family assistance center, the idea of a family assistance center. And that was really came out of the Oklahoma City bombing, and the coroner in Oklahoma City set up a family assistance center. And we used that model. Also, when there has been plane crashes, they've set up a family center. There were some models out there. The military was particularly well positioned to be able to respond immediately. And I know that over that night of September 11th, the military set up a family assistance center at a hotel, the Sheraton Hotel in Pentagon City, which was basically less than a mile from the Pentagon building on the other side of 395. And that was open for the victims the next morning. So people who were missing a family member who had worked in the Pentagon were able to go to this hotel and have a place where they could get information. They could get support services. They had the chaplains there, the military chaplains. They had mental health professionals. They had child care for people who brought children along. And there were briefings twice a day in the morning and in the afternoon on the progress of what initially is a rescue mission.
Because they don't know if their loved one is survived or what their situation is. So much of this, victims, family members, if you will, potential victims, family members, maybe is a better way to say it. They're trying to get information.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can't go to the Pentagon because they're fighting a fire there. And you've got, you know, search and rescue. You've got Fairfax County and Arlington County with their fire brigades are out there fighting the fire and trying to rescue people. So where do the families go to get information? We set up this center at a hotel So you would have also a place where they can sleep, where they can get food, and we provided the information, and then all the service providers come to that location. So the mental health, the chaplains, anything they would need.
Did some of the family members eventually, they wanted to go to the Pentagon? They wanted to see the site where they lost their loved ones?
Yes. So initially you have a rescue operation. At some point, several days into it, the rescuers tell us we don't think anybody else is alive in there. And it becomes a recovery operation, recovering the remains. And at that point, a lot of the families wanted to go over and see the spot. And so that is, we call them site visits. So they arranged for school buses to come to the Family Assistance Center. And by that time, the airline families were there, too.
Just a moment. I want to ask this. How many days after the rescue operation did it become a recovery? Do you recall that?
You know, my memory is that it's maybe 2 or 3 days.
Okay. At max.
Maybe the fourth day or something was the we had, and it was a whole intentional operation at the Family Assistance Center. The staffing, I was part of the staffing there. We were told, today we are going to transition people into recovery. And one thing I thought was incredible is they brought a lot of the rescuers in. So the search and rescue teams, a lot of members came into the room, the big briefing room, which was in the ballroom of the hotel, came in, and the families had a chance to say thank you to them. Mm-hmm. The rescuers, who had been working around the clock in the intense heat of this fire.
And the smoke. And all the acrid, all the poisons, if you will.
Yes.
And I can't imagine the emotions going on in the room at that time.
Yes.
That must have just been so powerful.
It was very meaningful
for both
the victim families and for the rescuers to see each other, and the victims have a chance to say thank you, and the rescuers to be in touch with the people that they were trying to help. Mm-hmm. And the family members of the people they were trying to rescue.
Wow.
So, yeah, that I remember you telling me at one time that was like one of the hardest days, because you have to like give up that hope of rescue and think it's now a recovery mission. But if you could tell us what you were talking about before, how, you know, the different parts of government, and you talk to us about how, you know, you run up against different rules in the different departments, and how did that get ironed out, that kind of friction?
Between the military setup and the civilian setup in terms of helping the victims.
Right. Well, there were more than a couple of times when we ran into issues where there were regulations or bureaucracy that said things had to be done a certain way. And when you're dealing with a crisis, you have to get things done. And you realize that rule does not work in this situation. And then how do you get around that rule? So one of the things that happened was the aircraft families initially went to a family assistance center at Dulles Airport that was set up by American Airlines. And that's required by law for an airline to set up a family assistance center when there's been a crash. But that center would only stay open for a couple days. And the question was, well, can those families that are civilians come to the military-established family assistance center that was for Pentagon employees, whether military or civilian, but not for other people? And initially, the military said no, that we can't use our funding for non-military or non-employee of the Pentagon. And so one of my jobs was, I think the second or third day after 9/11, was to try to set up another family assistance center for the families who are of the people who are on the aircraft. And we did get a hotel that agreed to do that.
And the Ritz-Carlton, you said.
The Ritz-Carlton down the street from the Sheraton. And we were getting it set up, and there was a great leader for the military's Family Assistance Center, General Von Alstein. And he came down and looked at what we were doing and realized he was going to have to be going back and forth. And he made some phone calls, and he came back and said, yes, the airline families can come to the Pentagon Family Assistance Center.
So when he saw what you were trying to set up at the Ritz-Carlton, in essence, what he said is, this is ridiculous. We need to allow you to stay in the Pentagon Sheraton there and served both sides, if you will, both yes. military and civilian. So he went to his people and said, listen, we need to change this rule. I think that's awesome. Talk about a great, great result.
Yes.
Very good.
And great leadership from General von Alstein,
yes.
and also the flexibility of people who understood that this is an emergency and we need to do the right thing.
Yes.
Somebody said they had been to the Pentagon Memorial, and it was a very well-done memorial. Is that right outside the building where the plane crashed, or where is that?
Yes. The Pentagon Memorial is in that area where the helicopter pad was, where the plane first landed or crashed. Mm. It was a parking lot area, kind of open area, and it is now a memorial. There's a bench for each person who died there, whether they were on the plane or in the building. And at night, it's beautiful. When you drive by on 395, you can look over at the Pentagon, and it looks like a big area of the parking lot has these individual lights on each bench. It's beautiful.
Can you imagine? Well, first of all, the pilot of that plane, that's what, six stories high, the Pentagon?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So to fly a plane as a novice, that's not, I wouldn't think, an easy thing to do. But the other plane, let's not forget United Flight 93,
right.
that was said to be headed to the Capitol, that the passengers were able to prevent that from happening, although they crashed in Pennsylvania. Heroes. Can you imagine if the Capitol was hit that day?
Well, those of us who were in downtown Washington, D.C. on that day feel that those people probably saved our lives.
Yeah.
And I do have that feeling on top of missing my friend who was killed and all of the victims who were killed and all of the heroic rescue workers who went into buildings and lost their lives trying to save people. We really feel a debt of gratitude to the Flight 93 victims who did overpower and attempt overpower the hijackers and attempt to take back control of Flight 93 because it was headed towards Washington. And the Capitol building was only a few blocks from where my office building was. So if you can imagine a big explosion in downtown Washington, D.C., it would have been devastating.
They saved a number of lives.
Yes.
By doing that. Let's roll. Everybody remembers that. So, Deanne, you've got a really interesting stat here. We're going to share this one in terms of the memorial right here in Traverse City, Michigan, and you took pictures yes. last evening of it.
Yeah, so I was so inspired after our talk with Heather, and just I have a lot of feelings about 9/11 myself. My cousin was in the Pentagon. But anyway, Traverse City has our own 9/11 Memorial Park, and I just want to make our listeners aware of that. It's at the Traverse Fire Department Administration Building on 897 Parsons Road, so it's the corner of Parsons and 3 Mile. And it's a beautiful, peaceful little park. You wouldn't expect it right there by 3 Mile Road, but there's a brick path that leads you and guides you through some pictures and the timeline as we were talking about this morning. And actually, there is a 3,100-pound steel beam located in the heart of the 9/11 Memorial Park. It was the portion of the floor support beam in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And interestingly, it leans 10 degrees toward downtown New York City as a nod to its origin. And it's something to go up to that beam and just touch it. You know, it's really powerful. And also there's a sign there that gives tribute. I don't know if many of you know, but we have a Traverse City native. His name is Brock Safranoff. He perished while working as a computer programmer in the North Tower.
Wow.
So please go visit that memorial park. It's beautifully done. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Deanne. Well, I want to speak for everybody here. We thank you. Thank you for your service to our country and the amazing power of your testimony. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's incredible hearing this directly. Now the third time, barely, obviously containing my own emotion. But thank you, Heather, for your work. It lives on in terms of what they can do to help so many others who are victims of these horrendous crimes. So great job. Thank you for sharing this. And I'll just say this, too. I hope to have you on again. We can talk about this maybe even next year, too. All right? Thank you, Heather.
All right, thank you all. Dennis Prout, Heidi Cartwright, Heather Cartwright, Deanne Jennings. Remember, proutfinancialdesign.com.